Open loops. Do, do. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, Conversations That Bend, a talk show for your unconscious mind. What is an open loop? It's an unconscious provocation, the cliffhanger, the thing that makes you go, wait, finish that thought. You didn't. The ellipses. It's really the open-endedness of curiosity. And it takes many forms, going down the rabbit hole, watching a movie and just needing to know how it ends. Guess what? This is an intellectual exploration of the topics that make you do that. Yes, my job on this show, as your cultural hypnotist and curator of all things abstract, esoteric, weird, and unexplained, is to challenge your existing belief systems and even bring on guests to do that as well, to stimulate your unconscious mind as you listen so that ultimately you think about things a little different and you can step into the highest version of yourself. Yes, I love these topics. I live for these topics, and I'm so excited to present the conclusion of the Reality Without Trance Deep Hypnosis Dialogues with Master Hypnotist James Tripp. This mini-series has been great. The conversation with James was back and forth. I mean, all these questions I had over the years about the way hypnosis works and the way he thinks about hypnosis, he gave it to me, and he gave it to me in such a meaty package that I was honored. I'm always honored when my guest comes on, but I was honored in a profound way of honoring to have him on and talking about me for this long. This last episode, Your Mind-Made Artificial Reality, goes into some other interesting areas. What about the use of covert conversational hypnosis? And the ethics of using that. How has James used hypnosis to get out of a parking ticket? How about this? Is mind control really a thing? Yes, and by mind control, I mean dark pattern mind control. And really, can you use hypnosis to get yourself to hallucinate? One of my favorite topics. He goes into all of it. It is a riveting conclusion. Some shocking moments too. Some shocking reveals about ethics. I loved it. He was provocative. That's what I live for. I knew I'd get something extremely provocative from him beyond just saying you don't need transfer hypnosis. So he delivered. He delivered as well. If you enjoy Open Loops, please make sure to share this podcast with anybody else that might be interested. And if you like these kinds of conversations, hey, it would really help if you could press subscribe on Apple Podcast and rate the show and leave a review. Even a few words can help. Now, are you ready to explore the fact that everything you're thinking at all times is just an artifice? Yeah. And even your response to that was an artificial construction of your mind. Yeah. Yeah. Let's go deep. Let's go in. Let's bring it home. Here it is, part three with Master Hypnotist James Tripp. Yeah. Yeah. You know, to get back to the jury thing for a second, I wonder, and the idea of conversational hypnosis, what are your thoughts on the ethics of using hypnotic language in like a sales call or something like that. Do you have thoughts on the ethics of indirect conversational hypnosis?
Oh, wow. That's...
I know that's another huge rabbit hole to go down, but I've never had a firm answer. And I've also, after studying it all these years, there's a guilt inside of me that's, well, if it's just influence, then why wouldn't I use a language pattern in this sales call or influence this transaction? That, and yeah, there's a guilt in there, but I've never had anybody fully be like, no, of course I'll explain it away to make you feel that it's just human nature. Though I almost feel like I'm close listening to you, since hypnosis is influence and vice versa.
Well, look, here's the thing. I was just reading an article today about the New Thought writer, Neville Goddard.
Mm.
And the person writing the article was saying, they were pointing out that Neville Goddard's book, can't think of the title, one of his books had been released the same day that Trump got elected, and that there's like, you know, it's like a weird synchronicity and all of this. But that Goddard's book is simply about, look, you have the power to create your reality. That's the bottom line message, like every other New Thought book. You have the power to create your reality.
Yeah.
And I read that book and I like it. I think it's a cool book. And the person writing the article was like, oh, it reads like a fascist manifesto. And I thought, really? I didn't get that at all. And in what way does it read like a, why is it fascistic? What's fascistic about it? And it's because the person who wrote the article seems to equate anyone having any kind of power in their life, they equate power and fascism, right? So therefore, if you increase your personal power, you must be a fascist. And that's coming from a worldview that says it's wrong, it's always wrong to influence others, right? But that's a hell of a world to live in, because everybody's trying to influence everybody all the time. It's just that most people try and justify their efforts to influence others by appealing to an external set of ethics that is right and wrong, right? Like the right thing to do is a wrong thing to do.
Mm.
Now, here's the thing. I have no answer to this, but I do make a distinction between morals and ethics. Now, to me, morals is your knee-jerk right and wrong response. And if you look at where morals comes from, there's an argument that some of it's innate, like people don't like unfairness. There's that clip of the two monkeys. One of them gets cucumber and one gets banana, and the one getting the cucumber gets really annoyed because it's not getting banana and it thinks it's unfair. And it's like, that's an example where someone's saying, look, morals, certain things about morals are innate. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Maybe it's just the stuff that we get installed into us unconsciously, the rights and wrongs as we grow up. But I contrast morals with ethics. And ethics, so far as I'm concerned, ethics is the code for living and acting that you adhere to, that you choose to adhere to, that you have thought through consciously, that you've sat down and thought, how am I going to decide how I conduct myself in the world? Right.
Right. Right.
Now, I believe most people don't do this. They do not sit down and they do not decide. And I'm not saying this is a one-shot deal where you sit down and you do it once. Myself, I revisit my ethics constantly. I revisit my choices about how I choose to conduct myself in the world. I do not try and claim absolute rightness or wrongness because I do not believe in external ethical standards. That's just where I stand, right? So if I choose to be kind to people, it's not because I think it's right to be kind to people. It's because I've chosen to live that way. I own my choice. I choose kindness. Now, I'm aware this is edgy for some people, because people go, oh my God, what's to stop people choosing sadism?
Mm.
Right? Well, probably nothing. And that's why there are sadists in the world. Do you see what I mean? So, like, I'm not trying to make out that ethics are easy and morals are easy, but ultimately it is about, like, well, how do we choose to conduct ourselves? I have my own code, right? And this is where generativity comes back in as well. So generativity, and I use the word a lot, it's part of my ethical set. I want, when I'm engaging with other human beings, I see us as co-creators. I see myself and the people I engage with in life as co-creators. Right? So we are co-creating something unspecified that is better, for everybody. I want to create a rising tide that lifts all ships. Right? Now, I'm not saying I'm always successful in doing this, but it's a way of looking at things. So when I engage with other human beings, I want to bring me up and I want to bring them up. I want us all to flourish and thrive. Some people operate from a zero-sum game default position. In order for me to win, you have to lose.
Mm.
Now, what I'm saying is if you come from a worldview that says, I think it's good to elevate myself and elevate everybody as much as I can when I can, and I recognize this is not always possible, but this is what I'm going to aim for. And I'm also comfortable in boldly going for what I want and trusting myself not to screw people over because I don't want to screw people over. So I have my own ethical set, and I'm aware that the things that I learn, that I've learned and I teach in terms of influence, could be used by some unscrupulous individual to put another person down, to win at the expense of somebody else. And you'll probably notice, like within the Hypnosis Without Trance online deep apprenticeship, I encourage a frame of co-creation. I encourage people to empower the people they work with. I even put a selfish motivation in as to why you will ultimately benefit from making sure everybody benefits rather than you benefiting now at the expense of others. I don't do that because I think people should behave that way. I'm not shooting on other people.
Mm.
It's just that, like, you know, I do allow my ethics to get carried quite intentionally with the material that I teach, because I would prefer, if I got a choice about it, that people would work towards everyone bettering their situation than playing, well, I need to get up, so you need to get down. I'm going to dance on the backs of the bruised as I make my way in life. You know, and again, I still don't let that go unexamined because I'm aware that we can get caught in reality tunnels. I don't. Do you know any Nietzsche? Do you know Nietzsche's master morality and slave morality stuff?
A little bit. I don't know that specific what teaching.
Yeah, it's just like if you start looking at it and looking at a lot of what people, this is edgy, by the way, but a lot of what people like look at as being good is really just like good. It's really more about power than it is about good.
Hmm.
In that a lot of the time people, if they feel weak, if they do not feel their own agency in the world and they feel like a victim of circumstance and all of this kind of thing, then it is psychologically healthy for them to engage in a morality that says those who are oppressing me are bad people and are wrong. Right?
Right.
You know. And I'm not saying this is right or wrong. It's just an interesting take. Now, of course, the master morality is that, well, look, I'm strong and I'm rising up. And they're actually doing the same thing. That the people who are engaged in master morality, they're just trying to feel good about themselves too. But yeah. If you're at the top of the heap, you're going to create a morality that helps you feel good about yourself. If you're on the bottom of the heap, you're going to create a morality that makes you feel good about yourself. Everyone's doing the same thing at that level, right? So a lot of the time, morality is often about people just like whatever they need to do inside of their head to feel good about themselves, even sometimes altruistic realities. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying it's an interesting take. The whole thing with ethics and morality is a minefield. At the end of the day, I do not believe in an objective right and wrong. I choose how I engage in the world. I prefer to see less suffering in the world. I prefer to see more joy and happiness in the world. I prefer to see everybody stepping into their power. You know, but no perfect version of reality is ever going to come about because reality is complex. But that's just my choice, is to come from a place of generativity, not zero-sum gaming.
So then, okay, I know this is going to be putting you on the spot, but I feel
please
like
you have put me on the spot. I want you to.
Okay. I'm curious how you would answer this then. Let's take the classic, how do I get out of a ticket from a police officer?
Yeah.
You're driving a car, you're speeding, and you probably shouldn't have been speeding. The cop pulls you over and is going to write you a ticket. And then you're going, well, yeah, I'm a hypnotist. And I want to get out of this, but I want to do this in a way that is ethically sound to me. Do you have a way that you might go about doing that? And how, and if you do, how would you justify it within the realm of morality?
Well, like, I can justify that easily in the realm of morality because I don't give a crap about the law.
Oh, that's fair. Okay.
Right? Now, some people might have just gasped when they said that. That does not mean, like, I will live by my moral code before I will live by the law. So I'm, so far as I'm concerned, those are my rules for living. I'm aware that if that puts me into conflict with the law, which it could, it mostly doesn't, but it could, particularly during the times that we live in at the moment, where certainly in the UK, nobody's allowed to do anything. You're not allowed to move at the moment. So, you know, like for example, like when I drive, there, I've just recently done a speed awareness course. In the UK, if you get busted for for speeding and you haven't been busted for speeding within the last 2 years, you can escape having points put on your driver's license by doing a speed awareness course where they teach you like why you ought to adhere to the law when it comes to driving. So far as I'm concerned, I drive according to what I believe is safe in the moment, not according to what the sign on the edge of the road says. I've been busted for speeding numerous times, usually for going about sort of 6 or 7 miles per hour over the limit. And I still take 3 points off your license for that. It doesn't change my behavior because I still think, I didn't think I was driving unsafely before. So I'm driving according to what I believe my internal rules are. So that means, number one, if the an officer attempts to give me a ticket, I will probably, most of the time, it's all mechanized now, I will do what I need to do to get out of it. So I can give you three examples of getting off fines right now using influence that I have done.
Great.
The first one was years ago, before I knew anything about hypnosis, right? I was quite young at the time. I was probably 20 years old. I was going really fast then because I was young, and I was on a dual carriageway. I don't know if that means anything in the States, but it's quite a big road, but it had a lot. They just changed the speed limit from 60 miles per hour to 40 miles per hour a few weeks earlier. And I was doing nearly 80 in a 40, nearly twice the speed limit. I got pulled by the police. And I didn't even think about this. I just did it. Some people are going to listen to this. They're going to think I'm a right scumbag. But I am.
No, I love this.
The officer came up to the car. I immediately, before I knew what I was doing, I was in tears. And I cried. And he said, are you all right? So I said, yeah, my wife's just left me. And I wasn't even married. It's complete and utter spontaneous fabrication. Right. And he let me off. So I lied. I cried and I lied. Now, like, as I listen to that and I think, crikey, you know, that this is like 27 years ago, I think, man, what does that say about me? Does that mean I'm a psychopath? Does that mean I'm a sociopath? Does that mean I'm a bad person? I don't know. I mean, like, at that age, I was on a different planet because I was like in the depths of all sorts of kind of personal insanities. And I've told the stories about how I came out from those depths. So I was like at rock bottom at the time and I did all sorts of things. Was it right to do that? I don't know. It's just what I did and it worked. Now, a more recent example since I started to learn hypnosis, which I've given elsewhere, is where I was getting a parking ticket outside of a fish and chip shop. And somebody came into the shop and said, has someone got a blue Vauxhall Astra? And I said, yeah, I do. He said, well, you better move because you're getting a ticket right now. So I ran out of the shop and I ran up to the guy writing out the ticket. And I just looked at him and I went, oh. Now, you can't see what I'm doing here, but there's a lot of nonverbals involved, right, in my gesture and my face. What I did was I did what I called a parody of crushed emotion, and I made a sound, like a sound of pain, right? That's all I did. Didn't use any clever language patterns, nothing.
Yeah.
And the guy looked at me, and he looked down at what he was writing, and he said, well, you're parked on the pavement. So my response to that was to repeat exactly what I'd done. I looked at him and did this parody of crushed emotion and went, oh, did the same thing again, right. just this. And he looked down at his paper and he went, well, move it now. And he pulled the sheet off and scrunched it up that he was writing out. Now, I told somebody about this a week later and they said, no, that's not true. I said, no, it's exactly what happened. He said, it can't be, because once they started writing that out, they have to finish writing it out. They can't pull it out. It's a numbered sheet. So that can't have happened. But it did happen. And that made it even more amazing to me, the fact that he would have pulled out a numbered sheet and then had a sheet missing. Would have had to have explained that to some higher authority. Now, I did that quite strategically. That one wasn't a spontaneous thing. That was a quite strategic and deliberate choice based on principles I learned from the book Flipgnosis. I don't know if you've ever read that book.
No, I haven't, actually.
It's called Flipgnosis, The Art of Split-Second Persuasion. It's not the greatest book in the world, but it had some gems in it about nonverbal influence, which I have continued to explore ever since then and since before then. So that was an example. I'll give you one third example. This is during a train journey down from Newcastle upon Tyne to London. I had to change in a city called Peterborough, but the train came in. No, it was to a town just north of London, so it wasn't to London. And I had a train ticket, and the train came in late, so I missed my connection. And I just looked and thought, well, how else can I complete my journey? And I got on a different train that went via London. So I went into London and went out. Anyway, my original ticket precluded me going. I could take any route that didn't go through London. But I chose a route that did go through London because it was the only one left open to me. So the ticket inspector on the train came up, looked at my ticket and said, you can't be on this train. I said, well, how come? I've got a ticket. I need to get home. And this is the train that's taking me home. He said, you can't be on this train. Your ticket precludes you going through London. I said, but this was the only train left to me, because your train that I was on before came in late. Your train. I was giving him ownership of it. When I make it his train.
Yeah.
Just messed me up. He said, well, you can't just break the rules at your own convenience. And I thought, okay, he's got a strong frame here. He's not buying my stuff. I said, it's not really at my convenience. It's actually quite inconvenient that your train was late and I missed my connection, leaving me no other way to get home. So really, I made the only choice that you people have left open to me. He said, you cannot just, he repeated his line. He was strong in his frame. He said, you cannot simply rearrange your journey at your convenience as it contravenes the rules. Mm-hmm. I realized I was getting nowhere with this. I said, okay, so what are you going to do? He said, well, we're going to take your details down. Then we're going to send you a letter and you'll receive a fine for £76. And I said, all right, then, get on with it. Do it.
Okay.
And he looked at me and he said, I'll be back. Disappeared and never came back. So really, when I said, go on, get on with it, doing it, what I was actually doing was I was modeling I don't even give a crap what you're going to do, because my internal reality was, you can do what the hell you want to do. I'm not paying the fine. I'm not going to try and stop you doing anything you want to do, but I'm not going to pay the fine. That was my internal reality at that point. And there's an old phrase, whoever has the strongest reality wins. So I think I stayed in my reality. If you can do what you want to do, I'm not paying that fine. So that's it. So those are three different situations. Two of them more nonverbal stuff, one of them more verbal stuff. The first one is almost psychopathic, I think, in its response.
Right.
But,
right.
But you know, at the time, I was probably like, I was in a very, very bad place mentally. I'm not saying that to justify it. I'm just saying that's probably why it seems so alien to me now. But I'm very happy. I mean, to go back to your question, I will operate within my rules.
Yeah. Man, now I just wonder. I mean, I didn't even go down this rabbit hole of what are other edgy things that you've done. Do you think? Okay. I do want to know this because I definitely feel like you have an answer. What do you think is the number one thing that you teach others that other hypnotists and change workers are angry about?
The thing that's annoyed people most really is just the whole, it's not a particularly edgy thing. It's just my thing of like, look, there's no special state that correlates with hypnosis. There is, you know, there's a hypnosis without trance. That upset a lot of people, especially 10 years ago. These days, people are much cooler about it. But 10 years ago, that really did upset people. I have a friend of mine in Australia called James Sakalos, who privately in a conversation shared with me an amnesia method that sort of kind of can wipe people's memories, or some people's memories, or make people's memories extremely hazy about events that have just occurred. And I was curious about it. So I ran it with a few clients, and it turned out to be stunningly effective. I only ran it with a few clients. Sometimes you get the old client who wants to pick over the work at the end of the session. So I decided I would do the classic, well, let's do some amnesia for the session so that they don't pick over the work. And it was really quite a cool thing. And I was like, oh, this is really good. I said to my friend, do you mind if I teach this? Because it's cool. He said, no, I prefer you didn't teach it. I was like, well, okay. Because his ethics, you know, he doesn't want people doing something, you know, nefarious or exploitative or dodgy and then wiping someone's memory for it or making their memory sketchy. Yeah. So I haven't taught that. And I know if I did teach it, he would be upset about it. So I don't, that doesn't really count because it hasn't upset anyone, but it potentially could.
My gosh, I'm heavily intrigued. Yeah, you know what? I wonder about the dark patterns. Heinrich Cleveland has a whole course, The Dark Side of Covert Hypnosis, and talks about, I mean, he goes into the work of George Estabrooks, which he has real stories. I mean, Kendrick, at least, or at least if I'm going to trust what he says, he has stories about being with a big name NLP trainer and this guy running a pattern on him at the time where he really questioned his entire values, his worth, and almost to the point of ostensibly wanting to end his life. And other people have come forward and talked about NLP trainers and abusing this kind of stuff. To me, James, I'm going, well, where were they at that moment in their lives? Was it really the hypnosis, or was it just skilled emotional manipulation, which again also could just it or just we've discussed that influence and hypnosis are the same thing. I mean, is there what you just described of your friend in Australia sounds like a quote unquote dark pattern or way of using this? Are there dark patterns? Are there dark strategies out there that can really do damage to people? And I'm curious if you've seen other evidence of that.
Well, I mean, I would say the thing that my friend told me wasn't a dark pattern as such. I'd say it could be used for dark purposes. But it's not like so much dark pattern. I used to have a guy that I would roll with some years ago on the street hypnosis scene who used to use kind of dark patterns on people. I stopped hanging out with this guy. He was a dodgy guy, and he liked manipulating people. You know, I did see him on one occasion. He was actually doing a card trick, and somebody was messing with his card trick. And he turned around and said to the guy, he said, "What is it that you dislike about yourself so much that has you behaving this way?" And the guy burst into tears.
Oh, man.
I said, that was a low thing. He said, "Yes, it's a dark pattern." So, yeah. He would use these things. He liked it. He liked causing harm with his stuff, which is one of the reasons why he's not, you know, he's somebody I knew. He was an acquaintance of mine, and he was a very charismatic guy as well, just aside from hypnosis and stuff. Most people would like him when they would first meet him. But he was quite a manipulative guy as well. So I think if you look at that, you find people who are like that. I have a friend of mine from many years ago, and she hung out with this guy who was probably a psychopath, and she had kids with him and everything. And the guy he gaslit her and manipulated her reality and screwed her over in so many ways, so many times, before she kind of finally broke free from his spell, quote unquote. So I do believe, of course, yes, it is absolutely, this is the thing, like people get caught in this dichotomy, like either it's absolutely mind control or it's not really a thing. Of course, influence can be used for dark purposes, for bad purposes. You can undermine people's sense of self just as much as you can build up somebody's sense of self. That's what a bully does. A bully undermines somebody's sense of self, maybe with crude technology, but that's what they're doing. So yeah, you can, you know, you can have people feel good about themselves. You can have people feel bad about themselves. I don't doubt that, of course that stuff is quite doable. And again, that's why the ethics stuff comes into it. And that's, I suppose, why, I remember years ago when I was doing Toastmasters, I did Toastmasters for a year and a half, and there was a guy there who absolutely went berserk when he found out that I was an NLP trainer. He's like, "That stuff is disgusting. It's manipulative. It's evil." I'm like, "Whoa, dude." But, you know, it can be disgusting. It can be manipulative. It can be evil. I said to him, I said, "When you do you're here to learn to speak Toastmasters, right?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I assume you want to have an impact on your audience." He's like, "Yeah." And I said, "So you want to influence them, right?" "Yeah." "Well, you know, that's what NLP is, influencing people." Which I guess that was NLP that I was running on him too.
Yeah.
To sort of get a shift happening. So yeah, this stuff, it is about moving minds. It is about influencing people. And that is why there are questions. You cannot ignore questions of ethics. People need to decide what their code is for acting, because it does increase your power to influence people. And as I think Spider-Man put it, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I don't want to get too much further down this rabbit hole, but I just, it's been on my mind since the beginning. So I must ask, the Jeffrey Stevens view of hypnosis is the closest to hypnosis without trance in terms of the provocation of it. Here's why. Jeffrey was like, he said in the training that I was at, he was going, "You do not," I think Jonathan Chase also, Jeffrey's the one I learned it from directly. He said, "Yeah, hypnosis is a highly associated state, a highly focused state or highly focused, whatever you want, like highly focused way of being versus trance, which is highly dissociated. Trance is something that he looked at trance as a phenomena that was as a result of hypnosis. And he was someone that was like, here's a framework for everything. No one's teaching you how a model for hypnosis that allows you to do things without trance, with trance. And he even painted it as a circle on the whiteboard, whiteboard, and the dot in the center. And what's happening is when hypnosis occurs, you're going from being in the whole circle to very quickly zoning in on the dot in the circle. And then this almost like a malleable area around the circle, between the edges of the circle and that dot in the center, is the subconscious mind, is what he called it. And that's where you get to play. In one second, there's no dot in the center where you're focused. And then the next second, boom, hypnosis happens. And then you can induce trance, induce hallucination, induce whatever you want, because you go from not being in hypnosis into hypnosis. Mm. Now, James, I look at your training. I do see that you talk about hypnotic focus, which mm-hmm. is reminiscent of that. Like their eyes are gazing at a particular point on the hand, and you are evoking, you're eliciting phenomena with more, I would say, linguistic nuance than even what he was doing, which was focus on this, keep your eyes focused on it. The harder you try to lift your hand, all that stuff, kind of more pointing to the principle of getting them to focus and then setting up the phenomenon. So that's what I got from him. And that's why he was like, yeah, you don't need transfer hypnosis at all. What are your views on why you don't need trance to get that phenomenon? What do you think
exists?
Okay. Yeah. And what are the subtleties of the difference between his views on trance not being necessary versus yours?
Okay. So there's a lot that I would agree with in that rendering from Jeffrey there. For a start, trance, again, like, define it. Who knows what it is? It's like a thing that starts to exist when you start to flesh it out. So I think you can create any kind of trance state that you want. You could shape it up any way that you want. So I'm more interested in not whether someone's in trance or out of trance, but how are you shaping up the experience? If you shape up an experience in one way and call it trance, there you go. You've got a trance that's shaped like that, so to speak. Now, what I think the issue is often more one of tightness of focus. At any given time, we are experiencing the world through the ideas that we bring to bear upon it in that moment, unconsciously. Now, I could be bringing a very narrow set of ideas to bear upon this moment, and it will shape this moment in a very tightly focused way that will exclude a lot of psychological maneuverability and ways of seeing things. Or I could sort of open up the focus on this moment and allow a lot of different ideas and possibilities to move through. So sometimes I think of it like as tightening things. So if I do a hand stick with somebody, I want to bring them into a tight set of ideas about what's happening in the moment. I want to exclude a lot of other possibilities. But if I was to do a more generative trance, to use that term from Stephen Gilligan, I would want to open up the bandwidth and have a sort of space or a kind of focus that was looser, but included way, way, way more possibilities. Now, when somebody drops into an everyday trance, let's say somebody drops into, go back to the three principles, someone says, well, you know, you're not insecure, Sid. You only think you're insecure. You're just caught up in these few insecure thoughts. If somebody's going, oh my God, what if I screw up? What if I screw up? What if I screw up? Their mind has got wrapped around a very small set of ideas that are not just making sense of the moment, but creating their experience in the moment. That's like what I would call a very narrow bandwidth trance. So I'm just using the term trance here, not scientifically, but poetically. You could say any state of being is a trance of one kind or another. So you could have a handstick trance. You could have an anxiety trance. You could have a love trance. You could have, you know, it's just, where are you at in that moment? What are you rendering up for yourself? You could have a trance of possibilities, or as John Overdove calls it, the trance of infinite possibilities. You can include more or exclude more. So I don't think, so where I disagree with, or I would differ, not disagree, but differ in my description from Jeffrey is rather than saying, well, there's this point and that's when people are in hypnosis. And they're always in hypnosis because no one's ever in the world as it is. They're only ever in how they're making it up in that moment. Now, so if you define hypnosis that way, as in an artificial mind-made reality, we're always in one. Always. There is no time that we are not. There is no experiencing the truth as it is, only what we experience through how we make it up. So I would say that there is no in hypnosis or there is no out of hypnosis. We could say hypnosis is happening if we define hypnosis as the actual process of influencing how somebody's making up the moment. Hypnosis is happening when somebody is responding to your directions and suggestions. That's it, in a sense. That's it. Are they responding? Yes. Hypnosis is happening. Are they not responding? No. Hypnosis is not happening, or at least not any kind of hypnosis that I'm running in the moment. You could argue their own hypnosis is still running, which I often do.
Yeah.
It's like if somebody says, I can't be hypnotized, they are hypnotized. They're in a trance of I can't be hypnotized. They're caught up in the belief that I can't be hypnotized, and it limits what's possible for them, i.e. experiencing some hypnosis. So that's a trance that I might want to shift. You see, if somebody says, I can't be hypnotized, I'm not going to go in and do challenge hypnosis. I'm going to think they're in a trance. They're in a version of reality called I can't be hypnotized. How do I move them into one that's more useful for doing hypnosis, i.e. I'm curious about what's possible, right? That's where I want to take them first. I don't want to meet their challenge head on. I want to shift their trance. I want to shift them into a trance of curiosity, possibility, anticipation. If I can get them there, now we can do some good work.
So when you see Jonathan Chase, who I remember watching these videos in 2014, and he's doing a demonstration where he's like, see, the person's here, and he does some arm catalepsy thing, holds up the hand and says sleep, and then he goes, see everybody, they're in hypnosis, that's it, didn't need to do trance, now they're in hypnosis. You're like, yeah, not really. What is really going on under that demonstration, I guess, is
what's going on under that demonstration is you've got people that are in a John Chase seminar, right? They've already largely, to some degree or another, bought into John Chase's reality.
Yes.
Before he does anything to them, before he invites them up for a demo, before anything. Right? So they're already in the John Chase reality tunnel to a greater or lesser extent. And you see this in the martial arts world, right? You see this. You ever seen these videos on YouTube of an empty force master being battered by an MMA fighter?
I've never actually seen that.
You'll find them. They're 10 a penny, right? Because these empty force masters, it raises the question, why do they think they, with their students, they can knock their students down without touching them?
Yes, yes.
Right? But they can't knock people who are not their students down without touching them.
Right.
Now, why is that? Now, if you ask, by the way, like when I, this is how I got into hypnosis, through like meeting an empty force master. Right. And I wanted it to be true so much that it worked on me, and I wasn't hamming it up, and I wasn't stooging, and I wasn't pretending, and I wasn't faking it. The guy locked me up, crushed me to the floor, threw me against a wall without touching me. And it was real. But it wasn't real. And it was only through experimenting around that experience that I went home and I started to do experiments on myself. And I thought, can I put myself into that experience? And I could. And it's the first time I ever floated my arm up, not from thinking about hypnosis, but from thinking about going into the experience of feeling my chi being moved, which he'd initiated me into. Now, all of his students sincerely believed, once I figured out I could step into it, I figured out I could step out. And then once he started to lock me up and push me around, I could either stay in that reality or step out of it. When he first did it, I didn't know I could step out of it. But the fact is, I bought into a broader framework and a broader set of beliefs in order to make that possible. And this is exactly true. So this is why when John Chase, for example, because I had this debate about this a long time ago when I said that hypnosis was not mind control, and he posted a video of him doing things that ostensibly demonstrated him making somebody do stuff against their will.
Mm.
But it wasn't. It was one of his students who'd already bought into the framework.
Yeah.
Right? And that's it. People are context blind. This is a huge thing with us human beings. We get context blindness, and context is very often king. What good hypnotists do, what good cult leaders do, what good empty force people do, what good politicians do, is they shape context. Psychologically, psychosocially shape context. It's what good scam artists do, all sorts of things. People focus on the moving parts of the game that sits within the context, and they're blind to the context. But the context is at least half, if not two-thirds of the game.
That is so good. That is so, yeah. Yeah, you've really shaped a greater understanding about what's going on here for me. Oh, gosh, you raised another question briefly, because I know you go into this. If you want to experience stuff yourself, I've always looked at myself as a bad hypnosis subject. Mm-hmm. Like I don't think I've ever experienced hallucination. No one's really tried the amnesia stuff with me, but I don't really think it would work. I feel like my critical faculty is very strong.
Yeah.
But I know you do a lot of, in recent years, I've seen a lot of self-hypnosis without trance, like a lot of personal change work. What's your remedy for changing the context of self-reality to be able to experience some of these extreme, I put that in quotes, phenomena?
Right. It's kind of easy when you know the trick of it. And you already know half the trick of it, though you don't know it yet.
Hmm.
Because you have identified the critical faculty, right? Now, the critical faculty is like a little scientist in your head that's trying to find out what's true. So it's trying to test all the time. This is what the critical faculty does. It draws out the sword of reason and slices everything up.
Hmm.
It, in fact, the critical faculty is by its very nature deconstructive. It takes things apart. Now, remember you were saying, Jeff said that hypnosis is an associative experience. You associate into.
Hmm.
So the critical faculty will slice up anything that you try and create with your mind by asking the question, yeah, but is this really? If this were really, then I could. Or whatever it does. So for me, how I do this is I recognize that I'm not here to seek the truth. I'm here to create experience. Now, so like if I've got a rule that says, but if this is really hypnosis, then this and this should be true, then I'm in the realm of the critical faculty already. So if I hang out in the realm of the critical faculty, I will create nothing. I will only cut things up and slice things up. So it's recognizing that that critical faculty has a very, very useful role to play in my life, but not here and not now. So I want to choose to align with, instead of trying to seek truth about what's happening in this moment in terms of my experience, like, but is my hand really stuck? It is instead to go fully into the creation and the enjoyment of the experience of my hand stuck. Right?
Yeah.
And that will happen, because everybody's quite capable of doing that, or even like a name amnesia. Here's what I can do for myself in terms of hypnotic phenomena. I can stick myself to anything. I can amnesia myself of anything for a sustained period of time. I can bend physical objects in a hallucinatory way in front of me to a certain degree, like my phone or something like that. And sometimes I can almost see a thing that isn't there. But like right at that point, I have to do such an immense amount of trickery with my critical faculty that I can maybe have it for a second. For some reason, that one, like stepping my critical faculty back on that one, is real tough.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I'd have to analyze why it's so much tougher than other things. I think, you know, as soon as, because there's some kind of different, what it is if I hallucinate something, it's of a different quality than the thing that's quote unquote real that's next to it. And I have to not only I have to sort of like go into the reality that there is no difference.
Hmm.
Do you see what I mean? It's like I have to go into the reality that the thing I hallucinate is no different from the thing that I don't. So it's not the kind of envisaging, it's that little extra step. I'll crack it at some point. My friend Jules, who I mentioned earlier in Canada, there's actually, if you're in the online deep apprenticeship, if you go in the side vault and you'll find a conversation with Jules where he talks about how he taught himself to really massively visually hallucinate.
Wow. Are you training this in people? Like if you were, are people going through any of your courses or trainings and they come up, wow, I've never been a somnambulist before, but now I've figured out a way.
Well, there's people in the online deep apprenticeship who have had their first hypnotic experiences where they hadn't before, just through changing their frames and changing their understanding. Because a lot of what keeps hypnosis out is people's rules about what it should be.
Yeah, I thought the automatic imagination model of Anthony Jaquin and Kev Sheldrake, I thought that was going to be the first kind of, at least that was the first time I heard somebody who, Anthony, who I respect a lot, be like, I wasn't able to hallucinate, and then once I started looking at it this way, I actually experienced something. Do you think there's room for your model to keep evolving?
I do, in a sense. I mean, I don't know. I think there's room for my understanding to keep evolving, and how that gets reflected in the model remains to be seen. You know, a lot of what I teach in terms of my model is kind of, it's not really where I'm at, but it's a stepping stone to where I'm at. And I can't necessarily teach everybody where I'm at without them going, you know, taking the stepping stones to this place. So this is one of the reasons why, like in the online deep apprenticeship, I actually have quite a lot of old material, but with additional comments on it, because the old material is actually better at providing a lower rung on the ladder for people to climb than anything I could teach now. So I sort of like respect that, and let that be. But I do think there is, and I do think that there's so much about how we hold this in our minds that, if every belief limits us, all beliefs are limiting. Some people can say there's limiting beliefs and liberating beliefs. All beliefs, they don't limit or liberate, they shape.
Mm-hmm.
And they include and exclude possibilities, every belief. Every way of seeing something includes or excludes possibilities. A lot of the time, I've been teaching hypnosis for many years, people come to workshops, they go, I really want to experience this. And I already know there's a problem when they want it. Right. And a lot of people go, but surely that's what you want. You want anticipation. Anticipation and wanting are not the same thing. Completely different things. But what people often say is they go, I really want to experience hypnosis. Now, I know when they say that, they already have an idea about what hypnosis is. And that idea is not helping them experience it. It's actually helping to keep it out. Right. So often this is, you get two sorts of people in hypnosis workshops. Everybody that shows up wants it to be real.
Yeah.
Right. And some people show up already bought in with a lot of anticipation. Great. They're going to respond really well. And other people are showing up with an idea about how it should be and wanting this to be the one time that it gets proven to be that way. So it's oftentimes like when I encounter that with people, the first thing I want to get them to do is to start to let go of their current beliefs about hypnosis, because that's keeping out interesting experiences for them.
Yeah, this is amazing. And tell everybody, I know that you have this new podcast. What kind of things are, well, first of all, what is the, have you landed on a name of the podcast yet?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of gone round and round and round in a few different things. It's probably going to be called just Chaos Wave. I have my reasons for wanting to slightly modify the name.
Yeah.
Because my YouTube channel is called Chaos Wave, or it's called James Tripp Chaos Wave. And I wanted to differentiate it from the channel. I didn't want the podcast and the channel to become the same thing. So it's going to be called Chaos Wave. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll link to that. Tell me this, James, what can we expect from this podcast?
Well, it's not a hypnosis podcast, but I I'm a hypnotist. So people will know me as a hypnotist. So really, actually, it's basically for explorers and creators and psychonauts and anyone that is walking the road less traveled in life. So the it's a conversation-based format. And the idea is the guests, the people that come on, there's only two criteria, really. One is that they're interesting and engaging people. And the other one is that they are making stuff happen in their lives.
Hmm.
Now, you know, so we're kind of looking at the life, so like, you know, the nexus of mind and life, the dynamics of living life, but it includes stuff like influence. You know, how do we create what we want? How do we create the outcomes that we want? How do we bring our ideas, our visions into the world? These sorts of things. Myself and my co-host, who's called Andy. Andy is a hypnotherapist and psychotherapist also. So we're both coming from that place, but it's not about hypnotherapy and psychotherapy. We're just kind of like having these conversations through these lenses and looking at other things. You know, so there's a lot of kind of cross-pollination. What is the same? What is the difference between what a hypnotist does and what a good business leader does, for example?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all sorts of crossover stuff. It's got a larger frame for conversation than just simply talking about hypnosis, but very much about the nexus of mind and life.
Oh my gosh. I'm aspiring to do a version of that show here, or at least when it comes to talking people off the different path in life. If you're a fan of Open Loops at all, anybody listening, definitely check out Chaos Wave, because I'm going to be listening in. Yeah, that's so cool. I love it. I love it. And also, what about in general for people to check out your work in hypnosis? What do you recommend people do these days?
So probably best still to go to hypnosiswithouttrance.com for that stuff. And my YouTube channel is James Tripp Chaos Wave, which has got tons and tons and tons of loads of videos on hypnosis on there and other stuff as well, around kind of using your mind to shape your life and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Hey, I highly recommend the deep hypnosis apprenticeship, or what is a deep master?
It's the online deep apprenticeship. Hypnosis Without Trance online deep apprenticeship.
I knew the words were in there.
Yeah, they're all in there some way.
Recommend
find that people can find their way to that through hypnosiswithouttrance.com if they're interested in learning stuff about hypnosis and doing hypnosis, and right from the kind of top level conceptual stuff, the organizing principles, down to strategies, tactics, maneuvers, these sorts of things.
Wow, you have been, I am so grateful that you've come on this show. You've been so generous with your time. And also just in general, like even when I was going through, I mean, I was looking through our Facebook messaging history. And we've been talking on and off for years, but you always gave me time. And I'm very grateful for that. And being so open to having these conversations. James, thank you for doing what you're doing as a contributor to this field that I'm in love with. And again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Greg. I've really enjoyed it and look forward to catching up again at some point.
Absolutely.
I want to thank James Tripp immensely for coming on the show. Again, fantastic. Really enjoyed the conclusion, really enjoyed his honesty about hypnosis, really enjoyed the shock value that he provided in at least part three, but he's been providing me shock value the entire length of his hypnotic training and exploration career. So thank you, James, for that, bringing a different voice to the community. And look, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you did, make sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss a future episode, as well as if you can rate the show and leave a review, it's very helpful. Coming up next in Open Loops, we have so many time travel episodes. I have so many time travel episodes, people who've claimed to time travel, people who've met time travelers, people who are researching time travel. It's coming soon. I might drop one of those next week for you. We'll see. Thank you all for listening to the show, and stay in trance or stay out. you won't be able to help yourself either way. That's part of life. Take care.